If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
So maybe it's in our 30s that the rubber finally meets the road and it's time to confront life. Maybe accept the fact that you can't be anything you want to be after all. In a way, that's a way to read Rachel Kong's short story collection. It's called My Dear You. Rachel says each short story is like a song. And, well, this collection sings. She joins us now. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
I read somewhere where you said that short stories are more like songs to you and a book or a novel is a longer conversation. Can you explain that for me a little bit?
Well, I think that songs and stories are, to be enjoyed in sort of one bite. And they can have, well, I haven't thought very much about this metaphor, but I feel that it's true, it's sort of more consumable in a way than a novel. A novel is a commitment, both for the reader and the writer. You're spending usually hours, days, weeks. For the author, it's taking years and years probably. And a song can come to a song maker sort of in a flash. It can come all at once. It can come to you in your dreams. That's how it feels to write stories for me.
I was listening to a friend of mine. We were on the radio not too long ago, and he said that he doesn't prefer short stories because he doesn't think the characters are as fully developed. And I don't know if that's true. I mean, reading some of the stories in your book, My Dear You, I felt they were pretty, I felt I knew them and felt them, even though the story might have been 10 pages or 30 pages. What's your take on that?
I think it's a little bit of an illusion that you can know a character completely at all, right? In a novel, you might develop a character, you might feel that you understand a character, but I think people are unknowable to each other, right? Like there can be mysteries to the most beloved people in your life. I think of it very differently. I think sometimes you meet people and they kind of just come in and go out of your life. And that's what a story is to me. It's sort of, maybe it's a brief encounter. Maybe you're not sinking as deeply as you might in a novel, but you're still learning about somebody. You're still with them. You still get to have this conversation.
I think it was Mary Gateskill who said that she once wrote a one sentence short story. Have you ever tried a one sentence short story?
I mean, I'm no Mary Gateskill. I would love to do that. That sounds amazing, but sounds but even does, harder to sell.
It does speak to it, the fact, though, that it's a conversation between the writer and the reader, right? Yeah. And so you can maybe convey in one sentence so much if the reader does his or her part as well.
Exactly.
I don't want to spend too much time on that, but just the one other thing that struck me was you say that short stories tend to tell you what you're thinking. And these short stories have been written over a period of some years, right? So what did they tell you you were thinking?
Well, they were written over the course of about 10 years. I think it's 9 years from the first story that was written to the last story that was written. And the stories were written pretty much during the period that was my 30s. And so one of the big things that I noticed when I put the collection together was that there was an interest in the limits of our lives and the fact that we don't get to live every life. I think that when we're growing up, especially in America, there's this belief that we can do anything, that our lives are limitless, that we can accomplish anything we set our minds to. And I was sort of coming up against that during the pandemic, during my mid-30s. And I see that reflected in a lot of the stories. They're sort of contending with the limited nature of our lives and the fact that we don't get to live every possible life. And there's actually a lot of beauty in that. There's a lot of beauty that can be found once you sort of accept those limits.
There's this an economist on TV
And he was talking about different life stages and happiness. And he said the happiest generation tends to be the oldest, which is odd because they're ill generally. And he said the roughest when it comes to happiness is, I think he said something like 25 to 45.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah. And he said that that's because that's when life gets real. When you're younger, it's not so real. When you're older, you're wiser, perhaps. But when you're in the middle, I think, of the period you're talking about, that's when you start to realize that my kids aren't going to be perfect. I'm not going to live in a mansion and things such as that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's just realizing that that you just have the one life that you're going to lead. And what do you do with that? At the same time, I think that writing is my way of sort of pushing against those limits, because I get to try on all of these different characters. I get to experiment with my fiction. And I always think of the Susan Sontag quote, which is, I think, what I wanted was every kind of life, and the writer's life was the most inclusive. And that's sort of how I feel about writing in general, is that even though I am my one person, my one life, I do get to try on lots of different other lives.
We do ourselves a disservice in this country in saying that one day you can grow up to be president. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when they didn't say that to girls, and now they now they do. I'm not sure it's true yet, but you know what I mean? If with this American sort of dream thing, is this disservice once we grow older?
I think it's good to have both, right? To have that feeling of invincibility, the limitlessness, like that gives you dreams, that gives you aspirations. I always knew I wasn't going to be president because I wasn't born here unless they change that rule. And I really don't want that job either. But I think that both are true, right? Like it's good to have those dreams, you know, reach for what you're going to reach for, but also know that you can't do everything, and to have, you know, the sort of humility to counterbalance that grand ambition. Maybe we're missing some of that humility in today's current climate.
I think you won't get much of an argument on that when we're lacking the humility. Tell me about, I want to talk about a few of these stories, but the one that has fascinated me most is, and I don't know how to pronounce it, Rachel, Capitum Lucidum.
I need to look up how to pronounce it myself, because I've only ever written it.
Yeah,
I've only written and read it. I guess I've been saying Tapetum Lucidum, just like you said.
And so that's sort of this character where you're talking about you can't have everything, or you're living one life that one of many that you might have, right? And this woman is starts to be visited by other possible lives that she might have had, other men in her life or other men and their families in her life. She sees them. Explain that for me a little bit.
Yeah, that's a story that it sort of arose not long after my husband and I adopted a kitten from the SPCA in San Francisco. And
it happens in the story. Yeah.
That happens in the story. This woman adopts a cat with her husband. And when she takes the cat home, the cat begins to see sort of ghosts, I guess, for lack of a better word. It's like you said, all of these possibilities for her life that aren't her present situation. So there's, you know, an ex-boyfriend that she had and the child that they might have had. It was something that kind of just arose from that particular season of my life, sort of recently married, adopting a cat. I was thinking about how strange it was that after all of this time, like, you know, being unable to make big decisions, I was suddenly making the biggest decisions possible, which is like, you know, binding myself to a person for the rest of my life, adopting an animal that would live hopefully for, you know, 20 plus years. And the story sort of unspooled from there. My cat was also my muse for that story because she, you know, I don't know if you've had much experience with cats, but like they're always looking at things and, you know, sort of staring off into the distance or spooked by various sounds and, you know, movements. So I was noticing that in her and then sort of letting my mind go to other places.
You totally get that with cats. But here's my real question, because Tapetum Lucidum, we'll say, refers to, you say in the story, a coating on a cat's eye, which allows them to, that's why they shine brightly or in the night. That's why they shine on us. But when I'm reading that, I'm thinking, okay, I'm interested in how the genesis of this did, how Rachel came upon this title to go that story, right? I mean, did the title come first? I doubt so, but
no.
it's such a specific phrase that, and one that we don't know. I'm just wondering how you got the title, how the two fit together.
I think that for me, writing and research are always going hand in hand. So I think when I was writing the story, I was reading everything that I could about cats. They're so strange. They have all of the, you know, they have a little pocket on their ear that I think is called Henry's pocket. But they're just so strange to me. And I remember reading about this layer, which is, as you said, the shining layer that's over cat's eyes. I think cows have it. There's a bunch of animals who have it. For me, writing is kind of a mix of taking, you know, things from real life, taking real facts, taking things that sort of spark my imagination, and then like cooking that together along with my own imagination. And so once I read about that, you know, that layer that allows the cats to see, you know, see more at night than we can. I kind of ran with that.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Translated from there.
So
let's go from Henry's pocket to the story Colors from Everywhere, because the character there and the woman has... I think it was there's a cavity or something behind her ear or in her head.
Oh, right? Yeah. She has a little hole above her ear. Yeah.
A little hole above her ear. That's probably not Henry's pocket, but then it turns out she's told she's an alien. I want you to tell me a little bit about how that story came about.
Yeah, well, that little hole above the ear is something that I have. I think it was just like a congenital, you know, thing that I was born with, and I've always kind of wondered about it. And it was fun to give that character some of the strange things that that I've had in my whole life, really. And with that story in particular, it was written right after I had gone through my own miscarriage. And I think that when you're in that sort of situation, when you're grieving, the mind is sort of casting about for possibilities, like reasons that this, you know, thing has happened. And so for that story in particular, I wanted to give it a very specific reason that she couldn't have children. You know, I wanted there to be an answer, because in real life there, you know, I think answers can be really elusive. Sometimes terrible things happen and we never know why they did happen. But for that character and for that story, I was interested in, giving her miscarriage a reason. I was also sort of mulling on, that word minority, which is used to describe, you know, people of color in America, but also is used describe, you know, something like a miscarriage is in the minority. You know, most pregnancies go on to produce babies, but a miscarriage is in the minority. And so I was interested in sort of that word minority and giving this character like the most plausible, not plausible, but like, you know, the most like clear cut reason why she could not reproduce.
And she finds out, well, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but she's told at an acupuncturist's office, and she responds by saying, are all Asians aliens? Was that it? Or are all aliens Asians? Something like that.
Yeah. I mean, she does say, like, I know this sounds crazy. This sounds like a crazy question, but I'm just wondering, since I am Asian, is every Asian an alien?
Different lives. So you were born in Malaysia. I don't know. How old were you when you came here?
I was 2 years old.
You were 2 years old.
Yeah.
So, and you, I would imagine, addressed or considered or danced around that idea of what if I had not come to the United States? What if I grew up in Malaysia? How different do you think you'd be? I suppose it's unanswerable. But
yeah. It's such an interesting question. That's I think, a question where a lot of my writing comes from, just trying to imagine different possibilities for myself and my life. I mean, I don't even know if I would be a writer, because I think that writing really came out of you know, my childhood. When I went to the library, I checked out all the books that I could from the library. And I was a really quiet kid. And I think that I began writing because writing was a way to express myself more perfectly than I could verbally. You know, I think I was still struggling with, you know, the way that my parents spoke English and trying to adapt that to the way that my classmates spoke English. And writing was where I could just, you know, be imaginative, fully explore, and like say things exactly the way that I meant to say them. So it's kind of an impossible question. I don't even know if I would be a writer. Yeah, I think a lot of my work explores that, you know, that sense of what are those possibilities? I mean, for all of us in the various choices that we make.
I was talking to Mark Oppenheimer a couple of weeks ago. He wrote the Judy Blume biography about the same sort of thing, because, you know, her first marriage was sort of stale, I'll say. I mean, she wasn't it was not fruitful. And so she went looking for other answers. I mean, had she been happily married from the get-go, would she have been driven to become a writer? I mean, that's one of those things we just wouldn't know.
Yeah, I think that so much of our lives are made from these chance moments, these chance encounters, and it is up to us to sort of be open to them, you know, to live life in such a way that we can be surprised and our lives can be transformed.
Tell me about you're addressing, I think you called it casual racism in this book. I was talking to my wife about it because I'm going to have her read it next. I really enjoyed it. And I said, it involves racism, but it's not racism that's, I mean, maybe it feels different if you're receiving it than dispensing it, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But the racism that we read about here isn't sort of the overt, I'm scared to what to say. You tell me about it.
Yeah, I mean, I find it sort of hard to talk about too, I guess, because I think that in a lot of the literature that I've read, there is, you know, often it is about more overt racism. Even my novel, Real Americans, I would say is about more overt racism. But in this book in particular, it feels so personal. It feels, you know, like I said, about certain sort of questions that I had and seasons of life that I went through, that actually in a lot of the stories, the racism that the narrators encounter is really sort of subtle, often kind of funny, because I do think it is funny when I experience it personally. You know, it's like, oh, you really think, you know, like, it's like I and a lot of my Asian female writer friends will joke about being mixed up for each other because it happens so often.
Where are you really from?
Where am I really from? I mean, lots of questions like that. I think that I was really interested in writing racism in a way that wasn't, you know, it's not for all the stories, but for most of the stories, racism isn't central to the story itself. Sometimes it's just almost something that the narrator is reminded of by somebody else. For example, in the first story in the collection, My Dear You, it's really a story that's about a relationship, about what it means to have a successful relationship, I guess, in quotes. And then toward the end of the story, there's a racist dog who won't stop barking at this narrator. And I think that I was, you know, I think that there an argument could be made that the racist dog perhaps doesn't belong in the story, because, you know, that's a different story. Like, that's the racism story. But I was really interested in having a story that included racism in the way that I often experience it, which is just like, I'm not thinking about what I look like what my race is every single moment of my day, right? Often I'm reminded of it when somebody interacts with me strangely, or when, yeah, a dog is barking at me or something like that. And so I wanted that represented in fiction, which I don't think it really had, you know, has been so often it is about making it central.
You receive that when someone says, where are you really from? Because again, I can't speak to it, but to me that speaks more to the person's ignorance than cruelty, right? I mean, I
absolutely
don't know. So when you hear that from someone, what do you feel?
I don't, you know, for a lot of these moments, I don't linger on them. I kind of brush them off and I just keep going about my day. I think that I set a lot of these boundaries for myself and I don't really obsess over them. But I was interested, you know, in the book itself, in having all of these moments sort of, put into a collection so that there could be a sense of like what they all accumulate into. I know, you know, yeah, a lot of these moments of racism are often really harmless. I don't necessarily blame the person. It's like, yeah, there's a lot of ignorance despite all of the resources that we have. And everyone is coming from, you know, a different place. I know some people ask that question and genuinely just want to know, and they're happy to tell me where they're from too. And I understand that, you know, I don't think I'm judging anybody for that really, but I was interested in the collection in, just kind of collecting all of those moments, having them not quite be central, but having the feeling be cumulative, like for the reader. So the reader could sort of get a sense of how it all kind of adds up.
I'm glad you referred to My Dear You, which is the title, but the title story as well of this compilation, because a lot of what you're writing about is the fact that things can go haywire, the choices we make, how things can change. Except My Dear You seems to argue for an inevitability of love. Right? I mean, so amongst this chaos and amongst this stuff that we can't control, that story seems to indicate that true love will prevail, if you allow me to say that. But I mean, what is your take on that?
Yeah, I think that story is both, maybe it does believe in that. I'm not totally sure. I think it's both hopeful and very practical at the same time. I think that I'm always interested when I'm writing in the sort of ways in which we don't quite understand one another, the way in a relationship, even with somebody you know so well, there are things that we still don't understand and don't quite know. And everyone has such a unique and specific perspective, kind of born out of their entire lives, right? Just like the entire life that you've lived. But I do think I have the sense that it is kind of a miracle when you find someone you really get along with, someone that feels like an old friend. And so I'm not quite sure. Yeah, I don't think I've quite worked out like what I believe about that, what I feel about it. But I do think that story in particular, It was like born out of this hopeful place, I guess, this hope that there is a sort of fadedness, but not in a way that that leaves us helpless, right? We're still making choices, and hopefully true love can find you.
So you start the book with the hopeful story and then throw it all to hell for the rest of the book.
Yeah, well, you know, ups and downs, I think.
I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Red Shoes as well, but we didn't get there. But that's the only, you made a reference there in Red Shoes. It's a woman living in Portugal. And there's a direct reference to Donald Trump there, if not by name, certainly by reference. And what was your thought process in putting that in? I mean, it's not a political book, but that was certainly a political point in the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when I was writing that story, when I was writing many of these stories, the time in which I was writing them, it was for the most part, you know, under the Trump presidencies, either the first one or the second one. And with that story in particular, I was thinking about the phenomenon of people leaving America specifically after, you know, either the first or the second presidency, feeling that they didn't quite understand what it meant anymore to be American, that they wanted to go elsewhere. And Portugal was a place that I think many, many people, you know,
relocated,
exactly. And so I wasn't, you know, some of these stories, they are about political issues, but not necessarily, like you say, in this named way. I don't think I mentioned him by name, and I don't think that, Yeah, I don't think that any other story really does either, but it was such a, you know, my writing has no choice but to be sort of a reflection of the times that I'm living through, both personally and, you know, globally, nationally, politically, whatever it is. And so I think for that story in particular, I just wanted to like include that little that little nod to it.
It worked. So have you ever played 7 minutes in heaven in your real life?
No, that sounds terrifying to me.
It's in one of the stories, but when I was growing up, yeah, that was like terrifying and hopeful at the same time.
Yes, exactly.
It existed in my world, but well, it did in my head quite a bit, but I just wanted to wonder about that too. Listen, Rachel Krong, the name of the book, My Dear You, what a weird way to end the interview. I'm sorry about that. I enjoyed talking with you. Enjoyed the book very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for all these great questions.
That's writer Rachel Krong. Her latest short story collection is My Dear You. You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I hope you'll follow this podcast. You can pick it up wherever you pick up your favorite podcasts. Until then, we'll talk to you next time.